Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett. Welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability.
Hi, this is Chris Stapleman.
Chris, we were having a little bit of an interesting conversation there. We decided to hit record. What we were talking about was resource consumption for standardized tests, you know, in the development practice, usually from standards, as well as regulatory standards that require specific testing so that the regulatory organizations can evaluate. And what's interesting is what this takes away from the reliability tools that the team wants to implement to discover the product and to measure and improve it. I was kind of curious what you thought about that.
Yeah, I definitely see that challenge where when you're an organization that has to test a lot towards compliance or other regulatory standards, there's a mentality in the organization of testing to pass. And so we do everything just in design just to pass particular tests and standards. And what we're not paying attention to so much is the testing to failure and learning about our products, knowing how they fail, and identifying the failure modes and then eventually fixing them, or at least knowing what kind of safety factors we have in our design.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's analogous to when you hear school teachers, like elementary school teachers, talk about the state or federal standardized testing and how they end up just doing curriculum for the kids to pass the tests, and they're not doing the curriculum that they feel covers what the kids really need to be learning. So it has this effect of, in some ways, diminishing accomplishing the real goal because of measurement. And it always feels like the same, like with the FDA and all the different types of, you know, tests that have to be done to qualify to get FDA approval. I see that pull resource directly out of the other testing programs we want to do to observe failure modes and measure characterization, all that. And that's very different than the pass-fail idea, because a lot of reliability testing and tools aren't about pass-fail, they're about investigation.
I also see that challenge in internal test labs where all the time and money is consumed by the regulatory or compliance testing, and there just isn't the time to test a failure. Now, we're trying to do some convincing to continue the test after you pass. So you pass your compliance test, and hey, can we have a little bit more time on this test to drive it to failure?
Yeah,
and that you know, there's like small wins you can get with that. You have to take it one step at a time.
Yeah, what I'm always looking for and hoping to have success with is combining the investigation test with the qualification test, because in the qualification test, you are consuming life, you know, to see if it passes a certain point under certain environments and conditions. So if you can qualify that the conditions it's under match a use case or can have other stresses added to it to match a use case, then you can continue after you've passed a qualifying point to investigate failures in margin. So I think that there is a lot of potential yield by approaching it that way rather than doing a hard sectioning from one type of test to another.
Yeah, you could potentially even increase your stresses after you pass compliance and see if you can accelerate the failure modes.
Right. It's a matter of tracking life that for what has been consumed so that you can add it on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on the flip side, there's some compliance testing. Compliance tests that are not really time-based tests. They're just, can you sustain a load? And how much of a load can a structure sustain? And you start loading it. There's just not so much a cyclical fatigue effect from a one-time static load.
So Chris, from your experience, you know, in your career, what were some of the ones that you found, you know, as far as compliance testing that had a big impact on a program?
When I worked in the solar industry, we did a lot of our reliability testing to IEC standards. So those were, predetermined standards, and we tested to 1, 2, or 3x of that standard to make sure we passed. But it still wasn't the test to failure testing approach. So we probably missed out on a lot of learning we could have gained through the testing approach. If you just pass, you don't know how much more life you have in your product, and you don't find the failure modes that you could design out of your product.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. You just said 1, 2, and 3 times the standard. So that's not just pass fail, unless that's because the standard would be a certain margin possibly, or just the actual use case, maximum or nominal use case. But to do 2 times it or 3 times, it means now you're exploring with your product variability that would still pass that standard. Or are you doing it just to see in the same test, you know, its capabilities?
It was mostly a marketing tool. And I agree that you are going beyond just a normal standard, and you may get some failures in those tests. But the driver behind that, again, wasn't so much the learning. It was a marketing tool to say, hey, we're better than the competition because we're testing to multiple times the standard.
Got it. Okay. But then what happens if you have a failure and you don't get to 3 times? Is that considered a design requirement? So then you're going to do redesign to get to the 3 times? So marketing can make that statement? Or do you just say, okay, we're just going to say we're 2 times?
Yeah, I think I've seen both happen.
Yeah.
I've seen both happen where sometimes we say, okay, 2 times, or yes, if it's a significant issue, you start changing your design or you change your materials.
Okay. So that's interesting. Reliability doesn't just have to get behind compliance testing in that case. They also are behind the marketing testing that they want to do. So you're third in line to do all your own tests as far as resource. I mean, there's some data you can, you know, poach, but I mean, as far as your full test protocols and requirements, that's pretty far down the list.
Yeah, you really have to fight for it. And at the time, I have to say, I hadn't worked in the reliability field for a long time, so I didn't understand the value of the testing to failure at that point. And so it was kind of nice to be handed a standard to test to. You don't have to think too much about the failure modes and how your product could fail, the physics of failure.
Yeah.
It's easy when somebody hands you a standard and says, hey, execute to this.
Right. So then if you have a failure and you don't comply with it, it's also nice then because you have something to back your statement of, hey, we need to stop, you know, the program and ensure that this gets corrected, which is great, which is so much different than as a reliability engineer observing a failure and saying we should investigate this, and that's it. It's just you requesting it in a sense.
Yeah, and another way to make a case for testing to failure would be if you do compliance testing in your product development, and now you release your product, and now you're doing lifecycle testing. So during your production, you also pull some samples, and you repeat that compliance type test every so often, once a quarter or so. You could run into the situation where in your development process, your samples passed. But now in your lifecycle testing, while you're in production, all of a sudden you have a sample fail and your product fails the compliance test. And now what do you do? You know, do you stop shipping that product? Do you start recalling it? If you really didn't know your margins, your product margins, you don't even know if the product has degraded over time or if it's just a statistical distribution that now, you know, you have the same population, but you just happen to grab a sample that's within that distribution that happens to fail your compliance test.
Yeah, that right. I mean, because you go from just having a handful of samples
pre-release to all of a sudden having this, you know, surge of data of going up to, you know, depending on the product, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. And right, exactly. You could be seeing a variability that was already there. And so in that situation, you had your compliance testing as a full screen in manufacturing, 100% units were being measured?
No, you would take samples every week or every month, depending on the test, depending on the product. If it's a cheaper product or high volume product, you know, you can probably take samples more frequently, depending on what it costs to test or the time to test and your testing capacity. It's a matter of resources and importance. Like what are the risks of not testing and not finding an issue? And I would argue that if you have good statistical process control in place and you understand your processes and the effects of your process parameters and your process measurements, you know, you have to do less of the life cycle testing where you put your product through a ringer. On the other hand, there might be compliance requirements that require you to test every so often.
Yeah. And then how about in that case you're talking about with field data? So you have units that obviously passed either your screen or your, you know, auditing, sampling, and manufacturing. But then when you're getting data back from the field showing failures, you know, of systems that don't comply, how does that change the manufacturing or program?
Well, first of all, you'd be lucky to get the units back so you can actually do failure analysis.
Right. I would think that almost is such a dirty data set that you could omit it, right? It would be hard, you know, because so many times you get back failed units and it's no fault found. So it seems like it would be hard for the regulatory organization to really come down on you unless there was an insane surge of failures. I mean, at this point, we're kind of speculating. But
Yeah, I'm thinking it would have to be a pretty severe effect in the field for regulatory to kick in. So would it be, you know, airbag failures or a car catching on fire?
Right, right. I mean, I have been involved where the FDA actually shut down production of that specific line because of what was occurring in the field. So there must be some threshold that then effectively states that there's no way this is just, you know, within the noise of the data to be happening with such a surge in synchronicity. There has to be something that's changed and is out of control. So that, you know, that then doesn't just take resource from the development, you know, we're talking about with physical units and testing and resource for testing. That's now going to yank resource of actual people and, you know, another project. So if we're working on the next gen product, you now lose the resource that went towards testing the lab, the budget, and now goes to this legacy product, which is a whole different issue, right? That's a whole different issue of project management. But if the failures in the field, I wonder with the failures in the field, maybe not affecting the customer so much, but affecting regulatory, that again would be another frustration of losing resource to that. I guess the airbag one is an interesting example. But I don't recall, with the airbag one that's occurred recently in industry, I don't believe there are any injuries. How did they, do you know any details about it? How they found it or what was going on that indicated there was an issue?
No, I was thinking of the big airbag recall that caused deaths because of the airbag was a material, it was like sharp material exploding and injuring people.
Okay.
Definitely severe, most severe failure you can have in the field when people get hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it seems like there's others that like with the, did the Toyota gas pedal one cause any death or injury, or was it just something that, you know, was obviously of great concern and observed, but didn't result in death? I don't recall if there was.
I would have to guess, Adam. My guess would be that it caused accidents, and then that's how people found it.
Yeah.
Or how it became public. There were accidents, and the accidents probably had injuries, if not worse.
Yeah. Actually, it would be good to have our listeners comment if they could, if they have experience in their industry or with their, you know, they don't have to reveal their company, but with their company of where a regulatory organization came in, but there actually was not significant complaint from the customer side. That would actually be really interesting if there was that kind of monitoring. I imagine it would be in industries where death or severe injury is very likely with any kind of product defect. But that would be interesting because that would direct resource so fast from development to addressing, you know, the field issue.
I could imagine this could be the case in the environmental field. So Environmental Protection Agency monitoring and finding that pollution levels or contaminants are on the rise without there having been any customer complaints necessarily.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. So long-term effects. That's actually a very good example of probably how that work. You know, and I was thinking with medical too, where again, there could be longer-term effects if you had monitoring in place in the field to, you know, in the same way where it's affecting patients, but it may be a significant period of time before the actual issue shows symptoms.
Yeah, and I don't have any experience in a heavily regulated industry, so I don't want to speculate too much.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's definitely an interesting topic, you know, and especially the part we started with. I just find so frequently that pull of resource that goes towards showing that it can do something versus actually investigating what's, you know, with reliability, that the interest is variability. So you lose the opportunity to study the variability for the sake of showing the design is capable of doing it. But then, as you said, you know, you get in production, you start to see the true variability, and you're going to, you know, find out if the variability is acceptable or not. So it's good. Well, it's kind of neat. I'm kind of glad that, yeah, we talked about that because it's definitely an interesting thing. And I think a frustration for a lot of people, but I guess really the only real strategy is to find ways to, you know, poach some of the testing that's being done for regulatory to feed into your reliability program.
Yeah. Helping people also, helping the decision makers understand the benefits of understanding your failure modes and understanding the margins of your products.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. All right, great. All right, Chris, thanks for taking the time to talk about it. And to our listeners, we, of course, love any comments and questions. You know, and as we put in there, too, you know, be very interested in that resolution of issues that happen where a regulatory organization gets involved with, you know, when you're in production, but the customers may not be aware of the issue yet. That would actually be a pretty interesting thing to hear some examples of.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Always enjoy chatting with you.
Yeah, it's good. All right, everybody, take care. Talk soon, Chris.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.